Hello, this is Mark Peacock, and welcome to the Travel Commons Podcast. This is Travel Commons Podcast number 103, recorded Thursday, January 24th, 2013. This is the podcast giving the voice of the traveler. It's more about the journey than the destination. Two topics on this edition of the Travel Commons Podcast: hospitality is personal, and tablets, phablets, and other devices. So coming to you today from the Hotel Monaco in downtown Portland, Oregon, Portlandia as it's known, at least on IFC channel. It's been a long time since I've broken out the mobile recording kit. And for Jeremy Phillips, who back in October tweeted, I kind of miss the bathroom acoustics. Well, here we are, kind of doing a little bit of a throwback Thursday in the bathroom of the Hotel Monaco. I'm back on the road again, sort of a mix of business and leisure travel. I flew into Salt Lake City on Southwest for a week and a half Christmas vacation in Park City. It's the first time I've skied Utah. It was nice, but I'll tell you, it was cold. I'd say the last 5 years of skiing over spring break in Colorado have spoiled me. I'd forgotten how cold Christmas skiing is. It'd be 8 or 9 degrees when we'd hit the slopes. I don't know, rising maybe to about 15 in the afternoon. So my first business trip of this year, 2013, was last week in Hartford, Connecticut. I used to fly there a lot, sort of 10 to 12 years ago. The airport, I got to tell you, it was a dump back then. So I was hoping that they'd freshened it up a bit, at least replace the carpet. That day started great. United upgraded me to first class, sort of milking out the last month of my 1K status for all it's worth. And then I'd also gotten sort of waved into the TSA pre-check line. I mean, I felt so lucky, kind of felt like the old Mary Chapin Carpenter tune. So I went and I bought a couple of lottery tickets at the first kiosk that I saw in O'Hare. An hour later, though, it all just started to break up, go pear-shaped, as my friends in the UK would say, as the airlines have taken seats, capacity out of their system, secondary airports like Hartford have been the ones to lose service. And so for me, booking this flight at the last minute, there were no direct flights available, so I had to connect. So big risk, breaking my cardinal rule of flying. But I just didn't have another choice. So, what do you do? So I picked a smaller airport, Cleveland, to connect through in hopes of sort of avoiding air traffic control delays. Now, my connection time was over an hour long, just in case that first flight was delayed. And then I scheduled myself to arrive in Hartford like almost 3 hours before my meeting, building in a buffer for delays that I might get coming out of Cleveland. So my first two strategies worked. Cleveland was clear, no delays, and my inbound flight from O'Hare actually arrived early, 15 minutes early. When I turned my phone on after touching down in Cleveland, both TripIt and WorldMate both told me that my Hartford flight was 40 minutes delayed. Well, okay, so that's annoying, but it's not fatal because of the back-end buffer I'd allowed. So anyhow, I go straight to the gate to get the story. What's with the delay? Well, the plane was 2 hours late leaving Cleveland because of fog in Philadelphia, and it's now ends up being delayed on the turnaround, getting back to Cleveland from Philly for the Hartford flight. Now, this is now starting to feel a little uncomfortable. I mean, I'd lived in Philly for 4 years, and I know what a nightmare that airport is. I mean, so I asked, is the flight on its way back yet? No, it hasn't landed in Philadelphia yet. It's getting a little less comfortable. The departure time had slipped now 10 minutes since I had touched down, which is not a good sign. Rolling departure times tell you they don't know what's going on. But again, still not fatal. So I sit down and I run some email. Departure time slips another 15 minutes. I talk to the gate agent again. Has the flight left Philly? No, but it looks like it's pushed back from the gate. I start checking other options. So there's nothing else going into Hartford. So I reach back for those 8th grade map skills. Well, what about Providence, Boston, Albany, maybe White Plains, New York? Well, there's a flight out to Providence, so I pull up Google Maps. It's about a 90-mile drive from there to my meeting. Look at the arrival time. I figure, okay, add 45 minutes for taxi, getting off the plane, walking down the terminal, getting to the car rental place, which would get me to my meeting with 30 minutes to spare. I draw a line in the sand. If the plane for the Hartford flight isn't in the air in 5 minutes before the Providence flight starts boarding, I'm switching. Now, I tell you, the United Gate agents were very helpful. I mean, they called ahead to the Providence Gate. They gave me updates on what was going on in Philly. But when I hit my decision time, the plane was still on the ground in Philly. So I ended up speed walking down the terminal in Cleveland to the Providence Gate. And as you might have guessed, later on that evening when I checked, I didn't match a single number on my lottery tickets. Following up, so at the beginning of December, I expanded the trip management app bake-off that I did in the last episode. I expanded that into an article for TNews, which is a travel industry website that's focused on travel technology. And so if you remember in episode 102, I compared the free versions of TripIt, TripCase, WorldMate, and Kayak. Now, for the TNews article, I used the same use cases that I did in episode 102, but I ended up dropping Kayak for the paid versions of TripIt and WorldMate. Now, the recommendations didn't change that much. I said, you know, pretty much the same thing. Use the free version of TripCase, but for $10, the WorldMate app is not a bad deal either, especially if you use an iPad. And then, just to show you that no good deed goes unpunished, TripCase ended up launching a completely revised version of their app and a completely refreshed website the week after my TNews review published. So I used it during my Salt Lake City and Hartford, or should I say Providence trip, and I got to tell you, I'm revising my opinion southward. Now, the new interface is fine. I'm not sure that it's all that much better, as much as it's just different, although I picked up the new navigation pretty quickly. But then I noticed I wasn't getting the normal iPhone notifications. I was getting emails instead, which you'll remember from my evaluation in the last episode, is definitely inferior to sort of the native iOS or Android notifications. And I tell you, I can't find anywhere in the app or the website how to re-enable them. And I've traded some Twitter messages with, you know, at TripCase, and you know, followed their recommendations. And then they said, well, they were having some problems with notifications. So, but it still hasn't fixed it. So I don't know what's going on there. The paid version of WorldMate does a good job with native notifications, as does TripIt. And also TripCase seems to have hidden where to manage social media notifications, sort of where to turn on and off trip postings to Facebook and LinkedIn. I'd have to say, after this redesign, you know, my recommended solution for trip management apps is a bit muddier. I'd have to say it's a combination of the free version of TripIt to push Facebook and LinkedIn notifications, and then the $10 WorldMate Gold for managing notifications on the day of travel. I had a chuckle a couple of weeks ago. I was kind of doing my weekly checkup of the Travel Commons site, sort of going through comments caught up in the spam filter. And trust me, you would just not believe some of the stuff that gets caught up there. And look, gets caught up there rightfully so. It's amazing what people shovel out there. And then I was also looking at some of the traffic stats like inbound links. And I saw a new link, or at least one that I didn't recognize, from Flyer Talk, which is, you know, the frequent flyer forum. So following it back, it was a topic that had started in April of 2006, asking for travel podcast suggestions. And I was pleasantly surprised to see Travel Commons listed in the first response. Thank you. And then again, bumped in 2007 with a recommendation, and then again in 2009 with listeners recommending the podcast. Then what I would guess would be a former listener commented, the content of Travel Commons podcast is interesting, but the guy's voice is monotone and metronomically slow. Alrighty, I'll take that as a half positive vote. Content good, delivery lousy. But then Bob Fennerty jumped in with his comment. I can see that perspective, but I find Mark's voice soothing and reassuring. Bob, I got to tell you, thanks for that help. And thinking back on it, I think the stint in the 70s that I did in contemporary Christian radio in Memphis, You're listening to the voice of 1590. I think that has permanently crippled my ability to be vocally exciting. Now, as longtime listeners like Bob will recall, one of my more nerdy travel hobbies is taking mass transit to and from the airport. Now, I don't know why. Maybe it's, you know, some sort of weird twist on train spotting. But, you know, even after getting my passport stolen on the train back to the Brussels airport last year, I still like to try these things out. I have sort of three criteria for good mass transit to the airport. Look, it's got to be clean, it's got to be frequent, and it's got to be cheap. So, you know, Washington's Metro hits all three of these, while San Francisco's BART misses on all three of them. Portland's MAX Red Line from the airport, that was great service, and it really hit sort of all three of those criteria. It was clean, it got reasonably modern trains, though they're more like sort of light rail trams, so they're not the fastest thing. They run every 15 minutes, so you got good frequency. You know, and at $2.50 for a ride downtown, they're an order of magnitude cheaper than a cab. And on prior trips to Portland, it's been like the cab ride's been like $40 or $45 between the airport and downtown. So a great deal, unless that is you don't buy a ticket. Halfway into my ride Monday night, three fare checkers step into my car checking tickets. Now, I had mine, but the woman next to me didn't. She said she'd skipped the fare machine to make her run for the train. The fare checker didn't have a lot of sympathy. As he said, look, they come every 15 minutes. She ended up with a ticket and a court date. He told her that if she had a clean record, she'd probably get away with a $60 fine and a day of community service. I mean, geez, that, you know, that's a big number for 15 minutes. I also had a good experience with the free bus system in Park City, Utah during our ski vacation there. We took a cab to and from Salt Lake City Airport, but once in Park City, we just relied on the bus system to get everywhere, to and from the ski areas, Park City Mountain Resort and the canyons, to town center for dinner on the what were very cold nights. I'll tell you, they're clean buses, extensive routes, good frequency, and cheap. They're free. So, again, they hit all the criteria. I'm told that it's funded by a piece of the local sales tax. I'll tell you, it was certainly a money saver for us. No rental car, no gas, and no parking costs at the ski resorts. And it was very convenient. Very, both of those, Portland and Park City, very highly recommended. Hey, if you have a question, a story, a comment, a travel tip, the voice of the traveler, send them along. The email address, as always, it has not changed since 2005. Comments, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com. Use the voice memo app on your iPhone or something like Easy Voice Recorder on your Android phone to record and send in an audio comment. I haven't had one of those in a while, and I love to play those. Send a Twitter message to M. Peacock, like Jeremy Phillips did, or you can always post your thoughts on the Travel Commons Facebook page or on the website at travelcommons.com. First topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is hospitality is personal. So during my Park City ski vacation, when I was lying on the couch waiting for my quadriceps to recover, I read Jacob Tomsky's Heads in Beds, a reckless memoir of hotels, hustles, and so-called hospitality. I got to tell you, it was a fun, easy read. I actually spotted it in an article in USA Today. But just looking at the cover, you can tell that Tomsky wants to give us sort of the hotel version of Anthony Bourdain's Kitchen Confidential. You know, that sort of flawed insider with a heart of gold, giving us that sort of snarky behind-the-scenes tour. Now, in Tomsky's book, this tour has two very distinct parts. Sort of the first third of the book tells us how Tomsky fell into the hospitality industry and began to make it a career. He finds that having a philosophy degree in New Orleans isn't, you know, the easiest way to get a job, and so he takes a job as a parking valet at a new luxury hotel. working hard and being earnest, which in his case means that he cleans up well and doesn't try and kill his coworkers, he gets promoted to front desk agent and then into management. Now, the second part of the book is set in sort of a gone-to-seed Manhattan hotel, actually where I feel like I've stayed before, where Tomsky lands very reluctantly. He's broke after 9 months of touring through Europe and then a following 3 months searching for a publishing job in New York. The New Orleans story is certainly the sunnier of the two. A young man finding his niche in the world, working his way up. Tomsky does a great job of describing the amount of planning and effort it takes for, you know, a Ritz-Carlton or a Four Seasons to provide that sort of platinum level of hospitality. And it's interesting, when he tells this story, the biggest target for, you know, the effort that it takes, where management focuses its time isn't on the guests, but instead it's on the frontline employees. Tomsky talks again and again about how amazed the valets and the maids, the front desk agents are when they're treated, say, to a pre-opening reception with an open bar, that the general manager knows each of their names. Little things, but things that translate into self-respect, pride in their jobs, pride in their hotels, which then translates into a drive really to give the best service possible to each guest. Now, if the New Orleans story is about a man on his way up, the Manhattan story is about Tomsky abandoning sort of bit by bit that Ritz level of service that he was so proud of, becoming more focused on hustling tips than helping guests. And as he slides down that slippery slope, sort of the snark level in the book increases, as does kind of a feeling, a sense of self-loathing. Everyone in the hotel is out for themselves, the managers, the bellmen, the front desk clerks, running their hustles, not necessarily to serve their guests, but to maximize their tips, which certainly leads, though, to some great service for some guests, but only those sort of liberally spreading $20 bills around the lobby. And here again, at this hotel, the tone is set at the top. But here, the general manager isn't trying to deliver the best service. He's trying to deliver the most money into his and the owner's till as quickly and easily as possible. An example that prompts each worker to do the same. I'm not sure if Tomsky meant to show this, but his tale, you know, clearly illustrates something we talk about often on Travel Commons, that in spite of all the technology being injected into the travel experience, the most important bit of the experience is still delivered by people. Hospitality is personal, and the two parts of Tomsky's story show how hard it is to build a team that prides itself on delivering great hospitality and how easy it is to build a cynical team that just doesn't care. The second topic on today's Travel Commons podcast is tablets, phablets, and other devices. I got to tell you, one of the most popular pieces of technology being carried by travelers nowadays is a tablet. Sort of walk down the aisle of a plane or a train, and you'll see half, maybe even two-thirds of the passengers sort of glaring intently into one of these flat pieces of glass. It started with people carrying Kindles, and then you saw iPads propped up against seat backs, but now it's all kinds. I saw my first Microsoft Surface tablet in the wild, that is, not in a Microsoft store, a few weeks ago when I was walking through a food court in LaGuardia. It was that sort of royalish baby blue mix, complete with the snap-on keyboard that they show in those advertisements for the Surface. An older guy sitting next to me on the plane on Monday was working on a Samsung Galaxy Note. Now, that 5.25-inch screen looked huge compared to my iPhone 5. I mean, he had told me he had it for a couple of weeks, and he really likes it. The key for him is having enough screen size to run email in a large font so he doesn't have to pull out his reading glasses. But it's small enough to fit in his suit coat pocket. The only thing that feels a bit funny, he said, is using it to actually make a phone call. He says that sort of big slab of glass feels like it's covering half his face. Now, I've been running a Google Nexus 7 tablet for, 3 to 4 months now. I think I mentioned it in prior podcasts. The 7-inch screen size puts it kind of in between the pocket-size Galaxy Note and the full-size iPad. Now, I'd run iPads since they first came out, the 1, the 2, the next one after that, you know, the iPad without a number. Like everyone, I thought they were phenomenal devices. But as I traveled with it, I had more trouble trying to figure out how the iPad sort of uniquely justified its weight in my travel kit. I mean, the same way I evaluate everything that I carry with me. I had colleagues who were trying to use them in the place of laptops and as electronic notebooks. I mean, it worked just okay for them. The iPad's email, client, and calendar app just don't have the same power as Outlook. And the notes they took with a stylus in, like, Evernote looked like, like a kindergartner's scrawl with a black crayon. Now, some guys carried Bluetooth keyboards, but it just seemed to be more like a hassle than it was worth. And then I found myself getting frustrated with the iPad's sort of sandboxing security model. Certain files are opened with certain apps. You can't get into the file system like you can on a PC if you want to do something more than an app will let you do. I think the iPad sandboxing model is a great model for probably 80% of the population, but it was just way too constraining for me. And so for what I do, an iPad wasn't going to replace a laptop. Now, how about as a media consumption device, as sometimes they're called, lean-back devices? I mean, the iPads are great for watching movies, but actually most of my media consumption is reading. And I found that the full-size iPad was just too heavy, both in my hand and in my bag, to be a good e-reader. So the laptop-iPad combo, it felt like there was just too much overlap. And so I started looking at 7-inch tablets. Now, I skipped the Kindle. I wanted to do more than just e-read. And I don't have a big investment in the Amazon ecosystem and wasn't looking to, get locked in any further. So I looked at the iPad mini and the Google Nexus 7. I gravitated toward the mini. I have a bunch of iPad apps. I am deeply invested in the iTunes ecosystem and just thought that the hardware was just very elegant. But pricing out equivalent minis and Nexus 7s, the mini was almost twice as expensive. And try as I might, and I tried pretty damn hard, I just couldn't justify that cost delta. So the Nexus 7 works fine for what I want. A lot of reading. I tend to use the Wall Street Journal app and the USA Today apps. I have work documents that I end up cloud syncing from my laptop using Dropbox. I'll watch the occasional movie or video podcast. I'll run Android photo editing apps like Instagram and Snapseed. And I've even done some Google Hangouts with it. It works for what it is. It works very well. One thing I haven't tried to do with it is, put an app on it to make a phone call. I tell you, that would be a lot of glass to lay across my cheek. Okay, that's it. That's the end of Travel Commons podcast number 103. I hope you all enjoyed this podcast, and I hope you decide to stay subscribed. I have no idea where I've pulled the bridge music from. Is it good? Did you like it? If you do, check out the show notes for the details, because I'll be figuring it all out in post-production. So anyhow, hey, if you have a story, thought, comment, gripe, the voice of the traveler, send them along, text or audio file to comments, COMMENTS at travelcommons.com. You can ping me on Twitter at mpeacock. You can always write comments on the Travel Commons wall on Facebook. Or, as I always say, you can go old school, throwback time. Post them on the website at travelcommons.com. Thanks to everyone who has taken the time to send in emails, tweets, and post comments both on Facebook and on the website. And until we talk again, travel safe, and thanks for stopping by the Travel Commons. Bye now. Life is hell, strange bed in a lonely motel. But one thing can ease my mind, no one woman that I left behind. Oh.
California to Carolina. She calls me up and there's nothing fine.